your revolutionary guide to the Green New Deal, and that is heard Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. It is now 2:30. Stay tuned for Live on the Fly with Randy Credico. That's coming up right about now. Stay tuned.
Of course, was Anton Karas' theme music from The Third Man. I'm Randy Credico. This is Randy Credico Live on the Fly here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. And we're going to get right into this today, folks, because Jeffrey Toobin is a very special guest. Plus, he's a New Yorker. He used to live on 86th Street, I believe. And he's the best-selling author of The Oath, The Nine, Too Close to Call, A Vast Conspiracy, and The Run of His Life, which was made into a series on Fox. Jeffrey Toobin, first of all, I want to thank you for taking the time. I know you're very busy these days. You're all over the place. Really, it's a pleasure to have you on.
Randy, a pleasure to talk to you.
Yes. Well, you can also, it's Randy Credico, a.k.a. Frank Pantangeli. I just read your book. That's one of the reasons why I wanted you on the show, because you have a good sense of humor. You had me on the floor a couple of weeks back when you were trying to explain one of these speeches by Trump, or an excerpt of his speech. It was like a paragraph and a half. And you said, I've been speaking English for 60 years now, and I can't figure that out, what he just said.
It's true. And Randy, we need to tell the audience that this isn't a typical, author interview. You were part of this story. You're in my book. You are a figure in American history now, if you weren't already. And I just think it's fascinating to talk to you. And frankly, I'm probably more interested in getting your views about a lot of this stuff than you may be in mine. I mean, I hope everybody knows in the audience that that Randy was a witness in the case against Roger Stone, and his testimony was very important. And Stone was convicted, and then his sentence was reduced after the interjection of the Attorney General William Barr, and then he had his sentence commuted altogether by Stone's old friend Donald Trump. Randy, can you just talk about how you feel about what's happened in the Stone case?
Well, I'm so curious. The fact of the matter is, I wrote a letter to Judge Berman, and first of all, people should know that I was leaning on you and crying on your shoulders when I had to testify against Stone, being that it's a weird position to be in, to testify in a trial against somebody. But I had no other choice, being that I was subpoenaed. It was either I testify or I would go to jail at that point. And what I wanted to ask you, and I'll tell you about how I feel, is the is what you said in this recent article in The New Yorker, that what he did, Trump, makes him worse than Nixon by giving Stone a pardon. Can you elaborate on that?
I believe that, but I think the whole story of the president's obstruction of justice, starting with when he was leaning on James Comey, who was then the director of the FBI, to go easy on Michael Flynn, to his attempts through his White House counsel, Don McGahn, to fire Mueller once Mueller was in office, the range of obstruction of justice is so much greater than what forced Nixon to resign. And then, you know, there's a wonderful example from the White House tapes, which I quoted in this in that New Yorker story you're referring to, because Nixon and John Dean are talking about how the Watergate burglars, you know, wanted pardons. And basically Nixon is saying, and I'm paraphrasing here, you know, I can't pardon them. You know, that's beyond the pale. It's beyond the pale for me to pardon people who might implicate me in wrongdoing. That couldn't fly politically. Yet here we are. The president not only engaged in the obstruction of justice that is spelled out in the Mueller report, not only abused the power that you know Congress impeached him for, but now he's commuting the sentences of people who still might implicate him. It's just so deeply, deeply outrageous. I don't say that out of any particular animosity for Roger Stone. Like you, I've known him for a long time. I've written about Roger a lot. I admit to finding him kind of a enjoyable rogue, a persona he cultivates. But I don't have any great desire to see Roger Stone go to prison. But the idea that the president could do it for his own benefit is just—it's just grotesque to me.
Now you worked on the, and it's one of your first books, maybe your first book. It's called Opening Arguments. You worked, and I really am envious of this because I'd love to have been part of watching that whole thing unfold. The Iran-Contra investigation by Lawrence Walsh. Now, he got pardons at the end. I mean, all of the defendants got pardons, I believe. Now, that wasn't a quid pro quo by George W. Bush. He was actually leaving office at that point. Is that right?
I mean, it was literally like the day before he left office or the week before he left office. It certainly was not done he had already lost the election to Bill Clinton. So there was no political benefit to be done. I think that was a gesture of anger, of sympathy for the people involved. But I don't think anyone at that point could accuse George Herbert Walker Bush of a cover-up.
What? Yes. All right. That's what I was thinking. What are the differences, or what did you learn, and the similarities and the differences between the investigation that you were part of with Lawrence Walsh on Iran-Contra and this particular one that you write about in such a great way? All the characters really come out. You think that prosecutors are dull? They're not. You really bring them all. Weissman and Jeannie Rhee, Andrew Goldman, people who I actually ran across.
That's so great. I mean, that's why this interview is so weird and great, because you actually were interviewed by these prosecutors that I talk about. Look, you know, I think, Trump made much of the fact that many of these people who worked for Mueller had made contributions to Hillary Clinton and other Democratic politicians. I think what's far more significant is that these were all experienced prosecutors who came at the job with a very sort of traditional approach, which is limited. Is that, you know, the prosecutors, when they're behaving properly, I think, you know, are not trying to change the world. They are trying to identify specific crimes and prosecute them if they can. They're not out to get anybody. And the irony is that, you know, Trump demonized them for what he said was their excessive zeal to get him. My main criticism of the Mueller team was their insufficient zeal in two specific areas about why they didn't subpoena Trump and why they didn't spell out his obstruction of justice in their report. I think that, but I think they were honorable people. I think the people I worked with in the Iran-Contra investigation were honorable people. I think these investigations are hard. They're not, it's not like you can just snap your fingers and assemble the facts in these situations. It was You know, I think that there were certainly limitations on what Mueller accomplished.
I agree. I do believe that there was a lot of obstruction of justice, and you do make a case that they could have, indicted him for obstruction of justice, even though there's some kind of rule. What were the limitations that you had back then in 1987 and Walsh had and that whole team? Compared to the limitations now?
There were actually fewer limitations on Walsh than there were on Mueller, because Walsh was what's called an independent counsel. He was appointed under the Ethics in Government Act by a group of lawyers. By a group of judges. He was part of an administrative structure that was separate from the Justice Department. That law had expired by the time Mueller was appointed. And Mueller was appointed as a special counsel by Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general. Rosenstein was Mueller's supervisor. There's no, question about that. And Mueller had to worry about whether Rosenstein would approve his actions. Now, both Mueller's office and Rosenstein told me that there were no examples of Rosenstein telling Mueller no. But still, the prospect of that possibility operated as a check on Mueller in a way that there was no such similar check on Walsh. That policy about, not indicting the president was in place at that time as well. But I have to tell you, there was no evidence that came forward in the Iran-Contra investigation that I saw that justified an indictment of Ronald Reagan anyway. So it wasn't like that policy inhibited us in any similar way to the way it inhibited Mueller with regard to Trump.
And, Reagan nor Nixon ever complained, I don't think, about the special. I guess he did about Cox, but Reagan never complained about Walsh publicly and kind of like allowed it to go on. I suppose he could have, fired him at any point. You say it's in the that the president has the ability to fire a special prosecutor if he only it has to take an act of Congress, or the president can just outright do it, which I guess that was hanging over Mueller's head the entire time, knowing how eccentric this president is.
That's right. And he was concerned for good reason, because it came out from Don McGahn's testimony that Trump did try to fire Mueller, and he was only stopped because his subordinates refused to carry it through. It was a very real concern on Mueller's part.
Right. Well, I'm sure if Barr had been there earlier, he probably would have executed the firing and had no problem with it.
I think that's entirely possible. Who would have thought that the attorney generalship of Jeff Sessions would look like the good old days? But it certainly does at this point. Yeah.
Well, Barr, here it is. Barr was involved in the pardons of Weinberger and Dewey Clarage and a few others. And I think Lawrence Walsh said this effectively kills the Iran-Contra investigation. And he rued what Barr did. And here he comes back now, and he's involved in this case. What do you make of Bill Barr? I mean, he's not well-liked by former prosecutors, and probably 80% of prosecutors.
The four words that sum up the entire Trump presidency, I think, are shocking but not surprising. And I think that applies to Barr as well. I mean, the way he has politicized the Justice Department, the way he has done Trump's bidding, whether it was, dropping the case against Michael Flynn or lowering Stone's sentence or, conducting an investigation of the origins of the Russia investigation. It's just shameful.
Right. What do you think another 4 years? What can we expect another 4 years of Donald Trump and William Barr as attorney general in this country?
Well, I think, if Trump is reelected, he will take it, I think, correctly as a vindication, as a ratification of everything he did in his first term. And we will see, you know, the first term on steroids, you know, whether it's, you know, approaching other nations as he did with Ukraine and seeking, you know, not the, you know, information and other initiatives, not for the national interest, but for his own personal or political benefit. I mean, that is, you know, what happens with bullies is unless they're stopped, they get increasingly demanding. And I think that's what we're going to see if Trump is reelected.
It really scares me, Trump. I mean, this is going to be the first time since George McGovern that I'm even in New York State, I'm going to vote for a Democrat. Can you believe it? The first time since 1972.
You're turning into a conventional old Democrat. You, Mr. Biden supporter. Now, wait, I'm not letting you off the hook, though. Talk to me about the Stone case. Well, how do you feel about, you know, the fact that Stone was prosecuted, you know, including for witness intimidation, and you were the witness, and how you feel about the fact that his sentence has now been commuted?
Well, let me say, as Frank Pantangeli would say it, I ain't got your brain for big deals, but this is a street matter, and that Jaime Roth, he's backing up that SOB. All right. No, listen.
Now, you have to explain to the audience the Frank Pantangeli reference, because this was not, you know, you're not just pulling this out of the air. One of the charges against Stone was that he was trying to get you to lie to the investigating authorities. And he says to you in text messages, do a Frank Pantangeli. And Frank Pantangeli, as all of us who know and love The Godfather Part Two, was the relative of one of the Corleone associates, who goes before a House, a Senate committee, and says, "Oh, I," and basically pretends to have forgotten everything he was going to testify to.
Right.
And one of the most hilarious things, which I don't even remember if I put it in the book, the prosecutors made a motion to the judge to allow the jury to see Godfather 2, which is certainly a motion I've never seen in a court before, because they wanted the jury to understand what it meant to do it to Frank Pantangeli. The judge denied that motion, but he allowed the FBI agent to explain what was in the movie.
Right. Well, listen, I testified to that, and I really didn't want to go there talking about Pantangeli. What it was Stone just didn't want me to contradict the written testimony that he gave to the House, the supplemental testimony, where I was, as you said in this book, page 266, I believe, that Stone did not, and neither did Corsi ever. They were unsuccessful at getting information from WikiLeaks. And what Stone did, and you describe him well, he is a grandstander. It's a lot of, theater with him and performance art. He just kind of, Corsi hoodwinked him, and then he hoodwinked the president as if they had some kind of contact. And I can tell you for a fact, they had no contact with WikiLeaks. But Stone believed Corsi. And, you know, getting back to the testimony of Frank Pantangeli, it's the Kefauver committee that he's testifying in front of. And he basically wanted me to say, and he said in a conversation on the phone, he says, "Say Roger Stone this, Roger Stone that. I was in the olive oil business with his father, but that was a law. The FBI guys wanted to make me a deal." I said, "Oh, sure, he did all of it. Well, they're all lies." Right. So, it wasn't part of my act. I never did Frank Pantangeli. I did it for one guy, Steve Sciarrippa, who was in, coincidentally,
in The Sopranos.
Yes. He's a friend of mine since 76. He worked Las Vegas. as a bouncer, and I used to hang out with him, and he always had me do this one scene from Godfather 2. Frank, he loved it. So whenever I see him, I will do that. It's an esoteric impression. And by the way, the name of the actor is Michael V. Gosler. Yeah, it's like, look, I did everyone that you were investigating, I used to do in my act as well. Back in 87, 88, including Reagan. I would say, I paid for this microphone, Mr. Green or Mr. Bream or whatever. So, but that's it. I'm an impressionist. And by the way, look, we only have a few minutes left. It goes by so quickly. I love your description of Jeannie Reed in this book. You have everybody. They all come to life. These characters in this. This is definitely a series just like the OJ series that was on Fox. This definitely is something that people should read. The name of the book, once again, is Trump's Crimes and Misdemeanors. And tonight at 8 o'clock, you can see the entire a big interview, a real interview online, 8 p.m. with a Harvard professor, Noah Feldman. It's tonight. So go to Jeffrey Toobin's Twitter account and just spell out his name, and you can get access to this. You don't want to miss this. I'm going to be watching it, and I'll be tweeting it out as well. Ralph Nader loves this book. He's a regular here at WBAI. He gave you a big plug on this book. He told everyone in Congress to read it, you know. So I'm not going to let you get off the hook. You lived in New York City all this time, and I was there. I'm hiding somewhere upstate, but I was there last week, and I went to Katz's place on Houston Street. Did you ever go to Katz's with your neighbor?
Send a salami to your boy in the Army.
Really?
Katz's Deli, yeah. Of course.
All right. Now, what was your favorite, Katz's or Second Avenue Deli, which I went to a couple of weeks ago with my friend, the writer Robert Eisenberg? Katz's is still the best, I think.
I have to say, I'm a huge deli connoisseur, but I've been to Katz's many more times than I've been to the Second Avenue Deli. The thing about Katz's that is so bizarre is they have the most peculiar ordering and paying system. You need, as far as I'm concerned, like a PhD to understand. It's not like where you go and you get a check like in every other restaurant in the United States. No. They give you these pieces of paper that you have to go pay first. It is so complicated, and they make you feel like an idiot if you don't understand it, which I never have. But, that's part of the charm of the
It really is complicated, and they have the best sour pickles. By the way, one other deal about your book. You called me, and you're right about this eccentric, but you also said that about Larry Klayman, and I hate to have the same adjective ascribed to me.
I should have gotten out the thesaurus, but anyway, Randy, I think you behaved honorably. You know, you didn't betray your friend, but you also didn't lie to the court. I just thought you were put in an incredibly difficult position. You didn't want to be there. You didn't want any part of this, and you didn't want to, you know, see Roger Stone go to prison, but you weren't going to lie either. And I thought you threaded the needle in a really honorable way in an incredibly difficult situation.
Well, the most important part was I was getting so much heat from people who thought that I was some kind of back channel facilitated Donald Trump's victory. And that's when I finally had to speak out. I spoke to a couple of reporters, and Stone went nuts contradicting him. And that one thing led to the next, and it got way out of hand. And sorry about that. And by the way, Jeannie Reed was right. If you go, get the buffet when you go to these restaurants, and go to the meat section first. All right. It really was a pleasure. And tonight I'll be watching you once again. Go to JeffreyToobin.com or Jeffrey Toobin on Twitter and check out his conversation with Noah Feldman tonight. And I wanted to ask you about your friend. I'm glad it's not with Alan Dershowitz. All right. It's with Noah Feldman.
Bye.
All right. Thank you. All right, folks, we're going to have to wrap up here. This is WBAI 99.5 FM, week would like you to support this station. The Greg Palast book is still available, as is the book on last week with Harvey Kay on Thomas Paine. Go to give2wbai.org and support the station. If I can't help the station out, I'm useless. All right? We're going to go out until next week. Here's a little Louis Armstrong. Thank you very much, Reggie. See you next week.
I'm flying high, but I've got a feeling I'm falling, falling for nobody else but you.
Mama, don't do this to say.
Mama, you caught my eye. I've got a feeling I'm falling. Show me the ring and I'll jump right through. I used to travel single Norwegian to Bangalore. Now I'm a tingle low with you. Yeah, Mr. Parson, stand by. But I've got a feeling I'm falling.
Oh, yes, I'm
falling for nobody else but you.
Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Askia Mohammed. Here are some headlines. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy said on Tuesday that he would suspend some cost-cutting measures and operational changes at the Postal Service until after the November election. It's not clear whether some of the changes, like the removal of sorting machines, can be undone before election time, and at least 20 state attorneys general have filed lawsuits against potential mail delays. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called DeJoy's announcement inadequate and said she would push ahead with legislation later this week to prevent election year mail changes and provide emergency postal funds. DeJoy is expected to provide more details on his plans in testimony before the Senate on Friday and the House of Representatives on Monday. Meanwhile, President Trump continues to falsely claim that universal mail-in voting will lead to widespread fraud and even an election do-over. The campaign to re-elect President Trump on Tuesday filed a lawsuit against the state of New Jersey over the governor's plan for universal mail-in ballots in the upcoming November election. The Trump campaign argued in the suit that universal vote-in by mail opens the election for voter fraud. New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez visited a post office in Queens where she blasted the Trump administration's moves.
This issue is bigger than any one of us. The Postal Service is not only how we send a ballot, it is how we get our medicine, it is how we send rent checks, it's where people are getting their tax refunds. It is a core service of any civilized society. And an attack on our Postal Service and an attempt to dismantle our Postal Service out of a selfish desire to sabotage our democracy and maintain a grip on power is an attack on all of us.
The American Civil Liberties Union released a report today on fatal police shootings in the time of COVID-19. The report finds police continue to fatally shoot people at the same rate so far in 2020 as they did in the same period from 2015 to 2019. The report also shows that several states saw a rise in the rate of people fatally shot by police in 2020 over the previous 5 years, and that Black, Native Americans, and Latinx people are still more likely than white people to be killed by police. The Republican-controlled Senate Intelligence Committee on Tuesday released its fifth and final report on Russia's 2016 election interference, concluding that the Trump campaign had regular contact with Russians and welcomed their help. The investigation supported many of former special counsel Robert Mueller's conclusions, including that Trump associates tried to get information hacked from Democrats and released by WikiLeaks in a bid to damage then-Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton's campaign. Trump has called the Russia investigations a hoax, but the Senate report rejects Trump's claim that the FBI had no reason to investigate his campaign's contacts with Russia. California Governor Gavin Newsom declared a statewide emergency to increase resources available to fight wildfires spreading across the state during an extreme heat wave. More than 30 wildfires are burning in the state. Utility officials have warned of more rolling blackouts due to power shortages as people rely on air conditioners to deal with the heat. DC Metro this week is scaling up service to near pre-pandemic levels despite financial concerns.